I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Oh, once again, it's good to be with you.
Before we start today, I thought we should probably remind listeners to go to the propertybriefings.com website and make sure they send in their specific questions. Because while we can continue to explore various aspects of commercial property investing, it makes a lot more sense to be answering those questions that are actually arising with our listeners on a day-to-day basis. With that in mind, I thought that George Romes left us a couple of questions a week ago. I can't believe that he's the only one out there who has questions. Anyway, here are the several queries he's raised. Who would be the best person to draw up the commercial lease, solicitor or agent, considering there is such a wide variety of tenants and business types? And is there a standard industry practice? The leases have to comply with government legislation in any way.
A lot of people are confused or can become confused over this because quite often a landlord will want a lease prepared really quickly and will say to the real estate agent, can you prepare it for me? And he is qualified and able to do that because the real estate, well, assuming they're a member of the Real Estate Institute, but the Real Estate Institute produce their own lease, which has been approved by the government as being appropriate for a standard lease. And the Law Institute also produce their own lease, which is similar but somewhat different in its implications. Both leases are good. My preference, if you're going to use a standard lease, would be to use a Law Institute lease. However, my concern is if you have your real estate agent prepare it, that he may unwittingly overlook some particular issue, or if the tenant requires changes to the lease before they'll execute it, and they may be well being advised by their own solicitor, then the real estate agent may unwittingly create a problem for you because there is no legal advice being sought. So I would counsel you to always use a solicitor, a competent commercial property solicitor. Now, sometimes if the particular property is complex, it may be more appropriate to actually have a more detailed lease prepared by that particular legal firm you're seeking advice from. And even with some projects, they have site-specific leases because there are special conditions that are required to comply with maybe some town planning requirements or some easements. I can't go into all the details, but it is really best to have a lawyer advising you whether or not they're using the standard Law Institute lease, which is very comprehensive. In fact, I like it because I always like pre-printed forms because the implication with a pre-printed form is you can't change it. And therefore, unless the tenant goes off to get legal advice, and even then it's a lot of lawyers don't like asking for changes to a lease that their own institute has prepared. So in that case, it enables you to get the document executed quicker. The preparation is a lot simpler because it doesn't have to be generated through a computer. It's only the commercial terms that need to be added to the schedule page. There may be a couple of special conditions, but at least having a lawyer involved, you know that they're being drafted properly. And so for a simple transaction, I would recommend a Law Institute lease prepared by a lawyer. And that way, you know that you have a sound document and that any variations have been vetted and approved by your own legal team. Now, the second part of the question is, whether or not there is a standard industry practice and do the leases have to comply with legislation? Well, yes, they do. And there is, apart from legislative requirements, there are certain acts. I mean, there's the Landlord and Tenant Act, and there is also the Retail Leases Act, and it has different names in different states. But there is an overarching Landlord and Tenant Act which comes into play with court cases, and it gets modified and so forth. But it governs the general conduct between a landlord and a tenant, as the name suggests. But with the retail leases, there are further requirements that need to be incorporated into a lease or sometimes removed from a standard lease when a retail tenancy leases the space, or a retail tenant leases the space. Now, again, we don't have time to go into it now, but a lot of tenants are deemed to be retail tenants, even though in many cases you may not consider them that. For example, anyone that sells services over the counter, so a real estate agent or a lawyer or a doctor or a dentist, are all deemed to be retail tenants. Now, depending on the particular state, that definition, I think, goes up to the second floor. So even if they're not on the ground floor, they can still be deemed to be a retail tenant and therefore fall under the jurisdiction of a Retail Leases Act, even though they're not on the ground floor. It comes down to what they are selling. And there's a bit of a grey area, but when you have some factory outlets, it has to be the majority of the space occupied for that purpose. So because it has a small shop at the front of a factory, doesn't necessarily make it a retail tenant. So those are things that have to be taken into account. And that, again, is a reason why you need to have proper legal representation, because with a retail tenant, there is also the requirement for what's called a disclosure statement, where you have to make certain disclosures, and they have to likewise make disclosures on their part, and each party has to stand by those. So if there's any misrepresentation along the way, the offended party has some recourse under the legislation. But again, it's just important to get it done right. So I would always counsel you to have a competent commercial property lawyer involved.
Last week, you gave us a greater insight into negotiating being the fourth vital step in your investment formula. So perhaps you'd like to introduce our listeners to the next step, being the validation of what you have just purchased.
The question of due diligence is an interesting one. Now, there are two schools of thought. Some people believe they should go out and do all their due diligence work and investigate the fitness of the property before they actually make their offer and finalise the commercial terms of the deal. Now, there are a couple of issues here. One, due diligence done properly costs money. Now, my philosophy has always been, why spend that money until you know you have control of the property? But the other implication is that if you go ahead and do that due diligence, which the vendor will know about, the implication is that when you make your offer, you are taking account of any impediments that you may have found as a result of doing that due diligence. And therefore, my preferred method is to finalise the commercial terms, document it, and there's a technique to doing this, but include as part of your offer the right to undertake a due diligence after the contracts have been exchanged, but still running concurrently with the settlement period. And you may seek a due diligence period. I always start out at 21 business days, but with the team I've got for my clients, we can actually do it in 7 business days, and that's not an issue. So it's important that you do that, because you negotiate the best deal you can, but and you agree with the owner that everything's fine, but you just reserve the right to check it out. And that allows you, if you do find any impediments in the structure or the information provided by the vendor, that you have a chance of a second bite at the cherry. So that's the reason why it's so important.
What sort of things do you have building consultants look at?
When it comes to due diligence and judging the fitness of the property that you've just bought, there are a number of categories that need to be fully investigated, and there's actually five in total. You've got your architectural components, your structural and civil components, the mechanical services, the electrical services, and the hydraulic and the fire protection. Now, they each require separate disciplines, and therefore, sometimes if you separately engage different parties to do the whole lot, you are left with the one coordinating everything and making sure things don't fall through the cracks. And so with my clients, and this is what the group I'm mentoring will gain the benefit from, is that we have that coordinated under one umbrella. And so therefore, all those are drawn together into one report. It's very clear whether there's been any aspect that's overlooked or simply missing. So you've got to look at, if we start with the architectural, the structural and the civil, and that is generally undertaken by way of a visual inspection, and that would include the main elements of the building, things like the building facade, the curtain walls, the perimeter walls, the roof and any roof plumbing, the ramps and the stairs, and other things like the driveway, the car parks, the retaining walls. And then on the building itself, the entry, the lobbies, the internal walls, the floors, the finishes, ceilings, internal stairways, the amenities, and the kitchenettes. Now, with these elements, the following report would cover things like an overview and the description, comments and observations, and also identifying, where possible, any suspected non-compliance and their recommendation as to how they can be rectified. So you can start to see that you don't simply let people loose on the building and say, come back to me with what you think. It's a good idea to have a very tight scope of works so that everyone understands what they're looking for and expected to deliver. So if we move on now to the engineering services, and that they fall into three different categories. Firstly, the mechanical services, which will involve a description of the existing system and then commenting on the condition of the existing plant. We're talking about air conditioning and making an assessment of the systems, whether they conform with the Australian standards. And also, you'd provide some commentary onto any corrective measures that need to be taken if, in fact, they don't comply for whatever reason. And then also take a global view of assessment of the capacity of the system relative to the size of the tenancy. And then you move on to the electrical services. Again, you describe the existing system and go through similar things as you would for the air conditioning or the mechanical, commenting on its condition, things like the main switchboard and distribution boards, your assessment of the lighting arrangement, whether it's efficient or not, the existing supply arrangement. You'd also comment on the general purpose power distribution and its capacity, because sometimes it's inappropriate. I mean, it may be a heavy usage of with computers, or let's say a stockbroker's office has just masses of screens. Some desks have two and three screens on them. Well, that draws a lot of power. It also will impact on the mechanical services as well. And so you have to have a consultant who can think this through and make commentary as to whether the services provided are appropriate. And then you move on to things like the hydraulic, fire protection services. Again, you assess the existing system in respect to its hot and cold water reticulation, sewerage, stormwater, and the fire protection services. Again, whether they comply with the Australian standards, and if not, recommendations as to how they ought to be made comply. So to do all of this, including the external things that we talked about earlier, you need some base building information. And part of the due diligence is I provide a shopping list to the vendor or the vendor's agent of things that we need to assist. And part of the reason for that is it helps keep the cost down because people aren't having to go look for and wait for documentation. So you need things like architectural plans and elevations, the service documentation, including drawings and specifications, as installed drawings, and this goes to some of the partitioning that the tenants may have put in. Also, they need access to the service operating and maintenance manuals and some of the service maintenance contracts, and also the building certification documentation, just to ensure that the occupancy is valid. And not having those documents means that sometimes the consultants would have to go to the council to get them, but most owners have that documentation available and can make it accessible either in hard copy or sometimes on disk. It doesn't really matter. But so long as the consultants, when they go through, have the ability to match up the drawings with what is physically on site.
Does this become a costly exercise?
Yeah, look, it can become expensive. And as I alluded to earlier, or just in the last question, if we have everything collated and available to the consultants, it makes their job a lot easier, more straightforward. But there's more to it than that. You see, if you do it as a one-off, and most property investors are not, unless they're pros, are not buying properties, you know, like one a month. You might buy one a year, or at the most two a year, and therefore you engage the consultants, and it's for them, the consultants, they go out and quote the job and come back, and you know that their time going, even though they might, don't charge you for quoting, it's built into the, what they quote. They don't have a relationship with you. They don't know quite what your expectations are. And so more often than not, it will be a solid, sometimes, I won't say inflated, but padded quote to cover contingencies and things that they can't anticipate along the way. So what I do with my clients, and as I said, the mentor group will benefit from this, is that I've set up these consultants in advance and I've said to them, well, what determines how much your fee is going to be? And they came back and said, well, generally the size of the building. So what we did was we broke the buildings down in what we call four types. And in other words, from 0 to 1,500 square metres are buildings that are under three levels. So that's building type number one. Now, building type number two is from 1,501 to 5,000 square metres. Again, it'll generally be under three levels. Then building type three is 5,001 to 10,000 square metres, and the building was probably over four levels as well. But even if it's not, if it's over four levels, if it's a slightly smaller size but over four levels, then that's a category three. And then a category four type building is 10,001 metres or more. Now, what I've pre-agreed is set fees for buildings types one, two, and three. And then building four clearly would be by negotiation or discussion after they've had a look at it, because in most cases that will be a far more complicated building. So, for example, the smaller building, 0 to 1,500 square metres, would be $3,800 plus GST. Now, normally, if they were having to quote it as a one-off, it would be somewhere between $5,000 and $6,000. Category 2 building type would be $5,900 plus GST. In other words, that's a building from 1,501 to 5,000 square metres under three levels. Again, if they had to quote it one off, it would probably be $7,500 to $8,500, because they've got to go out there, they've got to physically look at the building before they can quote, and this saves them the time of having to quote, because from their experience they know what type it is, and they also know that, being one of my clients, the brief is already pre-agreed. There's no surprises, because we've agreed on a brief to cover all the aspects. They know the form of the report, and therefore it is, when I say a cookie cutter exercise, that's understating it, but it enables them to very quickly get on with the job, and that's why we can turn it around within 7 business days, which is the secret in commercial property, is being able to do things quickly, not with unseemly haste, but to be able to make decisions quickly, have all the facts available, and do the assessment quickly. Because so many deals fall apart because there's a distance between when you initially look at the property or consider the property to consummating the deal, and then the gap between agreeing the commercial terms and signing the contract, and then the ability to get the due diligence done. So if we can telescope those down legitimately into time frames that are commercially sensible, well, then it gives you really an unfair advantage in the marketplace.
I can now see why this is such a crucial step in the overall process of acquiring a property. And if you get this right, it will obviously set you up for some good growth down the track. Anyway, I look forward to progressing all this further with you next week.
Yeah, and I plan to be there too.